Hello and welcome to the Search Enterprise Linux podcast on open source tools and apps, what's hot and what's coming up. You know, we hear a lot about Linux, of course, the poster child of the open source movement, but open source is a whole lot bigger than Linux. In fact, there are about 100,000 open source products, and many of them could be right for your company. In this podcast, we're going to talk to open source author and guru Bernard Golden. Bernard is an entrepreneur. He is the president of Navica, which is a company he founded 4 years ago with a mission to deliver great products to clients based on open source solutions. He is an author. He is a longtime software executive, and he's also the author of Golden's Rules, a column, a very popular column on Search Enterprise Linux. We're going to delve into some of the new options for open source applications here. So, Bernard, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Paul.
I thought first let's define our terms, because maybe not everybody who's listening in on the podcast is familiar with what exactly open source is. Now, open source does not equal free necessarily. Open source is, in fact, there are several different kinds of open source licenses, and maybe you could explain what some of the most popular ones are.
Yeah, well, let's start by talking about kind of the differences between open source and commercial software, because that gives a good grounding. Both commercial software, or proprietary software, and open source are copyrighted intellectual property works. And whoever holds the copyright has the right to let other people use it, so-called to license it. With commercial software, that license is typically very restrictive. It sort of says, here is this product. I will sell you a license to use my copyrighted work on your computer, but I'm only going to distribute to you in binary format, so it'll run, but you can't see the source code that, you know, the native intellectual property. I'm going to let you run it on a certain number of machines or a certain type of machine and so forth and so on. So it's very closely held. Open source, by contrast, again, intellectual property work that's copyrighted and distributed, but the license is a license designed to increase use. It's a very inclusive license that says you are welcome to use it in any way you see fit. You can take this product, the binary, if it's available, and put it on one machine or 100 machines. It's up to you. You can use it in any fashion you want. By the way, here's the source code. You can also take the source code and modify the product if you'd like. And so it's a very inclusive license that makes it very useful for people to use, and also encourages people to improve the intellectual property. Now, the difference in open source licenses is some of them say if you change that intellectual property received and distribute the resulting product, so I take a product and I tinker with it, and then I say here to my friend, why don't you try what I've done and distribute it, then some licenses impose the requirement that I also distribute the source code. Other open source licenses say you don't have to do that. You can distribute the resulting product, but you are not required to distribute the source code as well. And what that means is that I don't have the ability to keep those changes that I've made to the product closely held and only release a binary of the product. And the GPL is the most common of the ones that impose that redistribution, or reciprocity is often called, requirements. Berkeley-style licenses enable people to make products and closely hold those things. And what that means is you can take an open source product and convert it into a commercial product with those Berkeley-style licenses. That's the key distinction between the types of licenses.
Explain that, because if you could dig into that a little bit more, because we see, on the one hand, we see some vendors, Computer Associates did this recently, taking a commercial product, which was Ingress, and putting it out into the open source market. In other cases, we see vendors taking open source products and integrating it into commercial products and then charging a fee for them. Now, is that all covered under the GPL, the General Public License, or are those different? Is that a BSD license, or what is? How does that work?
In the case of Ingress, Computer Associates holds that intellectual property. They hold the copyright, I should say, on that intellectual property. And formerly, they distributed under a very restrictive license. They have since put it out under a different license. Now, they happen to have written their own license. to do that. But it's a very, you know, it's an open source license that has reciprocity requirements. So you can't take the Ingress source code, you know, I couldn't take the Ingress source code, tinker with it, and then call it, you know, Navica database. I would be required to contribute those back. So that's kind of how that works with the with a commercial product that's been converted into an open source product. They've changed the licensing conditions under which they distribute the product.
Now, I can also take in some cases an open source product and I can build a commercial proprietary product around it. Is that true?
That's right. That's those so-called Berkeley style licenses. They enable you to take an existing open source product, take the source code, modify it, and then distribute the resulting product without a requirement to distribute the source code for it. So in essence, I end up distributing a binary product that has restrictive conditions on it, so it looks more like a commercial product. So it does not impose those reciprocity kinds of conditions on if I distribute the changes that I've made.
Now, there is a common, I think, question that enterprise IT customers would have, I'd imagine, which is, what's the motivation? Why should people create software and put it out there for free, never hoping to make a dollar off of it? Aren't I safer? Aren't I going to get a better product if I buy it from a company that has a profit motive?
Well, there's two questions there. One is, why would people do it? And really, there's a variety of motivations for people. Many of the people who create open source software do it for pure love of programming. It's just their artistic expression, and they enjoy doing it, and so they do it as a passion on a volunteer basis. Some folks do it because that's an area that they want to explore and work on. A lot of folks, it's called sort of scratching your own itch. They are people who had to build a tool to solve their own problem that they faced, and they said, well, you know, now that I've built it for myself, why not put it out for other people to use too? Because I have, you know, the problem I have is a common problem, so I'll share it with people. And then those people contribute to it as well, and it improves the product. About 30% of the people who work on open source products actually do it as part of their employment. So they might work for, you know, IBM or some IT company or within a company, and that's their job. They're asked to work on, for example, the Apache web server. A company will say, you know, it needs to be better for this in this area because that's what we need to do. Bob, you work on it and do that, but contribute it back to the open source product. So that's the motivation side. And the other side about, you know, can you trust that kind of software? You know, that's a common question, and certainly I brought that. My background is big enterprise software companies, and my initial reaction was, well, this stuff can't be as good as what we used to build. But in fact, it turns out that a lot of it is very high quality. And part that's because the people who write it are very passionate and very capable and very talented, but also because it gets used a lot. And in being used, the challenges, the problems, the bugs get addressed, fixes get submitted, and the product evolves and improves in its quality. So that's a far broader range of usage than a typical commercial product would have access to through its typical development and QA group development effort or engineering process.
Well, why do you think the explosion of interest right now? I mean, you go to sourceforge.net, and it's almost overwhelming how many how many products that are there, how many projects are partway through completion. You almost don't know where to begin. Why is there suddenly so much activity in the open source area?
I think it's a confluence of a number of events. One is, you know, the formerly restrictive conditions that dictated kind of commercial companies building software. So expensive hardware, no bandwidth availability. You really need to bring people together in a central location to build software. Well, that's all ended. You know, hardware is dirt cheap these days. Internet connectivity is all over the world. There's broadband available. So people from all over the world can collaborate. And that really brings forward the ability to, you know, I can work with somebody in Australia and somebody in Czechoslovakia to jointly build a product that all of us can find useful. That's one side. The other side is really IT has become a much more cost-conscious discipline. in the past, it almost seemed like there, you know, money was endless, right? You know, we need to get on the internet. We need to do client server. We need to do Y2K. Just money got shoveled into IT groups. Well, now that's not happening, and they have to be much more cost conscious. And so they're more open to lower cost or free solutions. So there's a lot of interest in using open source. So, you know, those are the trends that I see that have really started driving it.
Interesting. Yeah, certainly cost consciousness is driving a lot of is a dominating issue with IT organizations now. Let's talk about some new areas. Of course, a lot of people are familiar with Linux and Apache and SendMail and some of the more Firefox, certainly some of the more popular open source products. But there are many new application areas that are being investigated now, and where open source is making inroads. What do you think are some of the more interesting ones?
Well, you know, one phrase that gets used a lot about open source is it's moving up the stack. So, you know, it started off with an operating system. Databases are very well represented in open source products through MySQL and Postgres and Ingress, as you pointed out. Application servers, web servers. We're starting to see, you know, sort of end-user applications that are ERP or CRM type apps through a Compere or a Sugar CRM. Those are very well known. There's other interesting technologies that are getting addressed as well. So, for example, business intelligence data warehousing. That's been an area that everyone's known, if they applied it, they could probably get real value for their businesses. But it's always been one of those things that was kind of, it's not transactional. We don't need it to keep our business running. So it never really got as much attention, or it never got the budget dollars. Well, through open source, there's real opportunities for companies to begin using open source to address business intelligence data warehousing. I'll just give you an example. Sabre Holdings has built an open source data warehouse to examine how people go through their Travelocity website. So they're able to analyze what do people typically, you know, how do they go through the Travelocity site? What kinds of things do they find interesting to click on? They've built an incredible multi-terabyte data warehouse that, if they'd used commercial products, probably would have cost $1 million. They've built it for $50,000 using MySQL and some hardware. So it gives them an opportunity to do that, and that's the kind of thing you'll see coming forward with business intelligence. The explosion of hardware, inexpensive operating systems has really started to look at other areas, like people are doing clustering with systems or virtualization. That's a very popular topic. How do I take better advantage of my existing hardware, you know, through virtualization and creating server pools? So there's a product out called Zen, which, unlike the religious discipline or philosophical discipline, is spelled X-E-N, and it's a virtualization product that enables you to have multiple Linux instances running on a single box. With the explosion of power of hardware, you can now run 6 or 8 instances of virtual Linux machines on a box. So, for example, when I was running a big engineering group, we always had scads and scads of servers. We needed a bunch of them for developers. We needed a bunch for QA. We needed a bunch for the build people. Well, with the power of hardware available through these new 64-bit chips and so forth, you could actually put a lot of those groups onto a single box. And that's obviously much more cost-effective, both from a hardware standpoint, but also from an administrative standpoint. So virtualization is another area that, you know, is very hot. At the Linux World last week, it was all over the place. It's something that's going to become a big issue. And open source, huge. That's a huge place where it'll be playing in the future.
Well, now, you mentioned Zen. It's interesting that Zen is a fairly new product, I would assume.
Yeah, it's been around for maybe a couple of years and really became pretty kind of burst into consciousness about a year ago. So it's a coming product, I guess I'd say.
Is it possible for you to compare the features or the robustness of Zen to some of the commercial counterparts, or how would it be different or the same?
Well, you know, the most obvious commercial counterpart is VMware, and that's a very well-established product that's available through EMC. And what I happened to recently see a presentation by one of the founders of Zen at my local Linux users group. And in terms of functionality, Xen offers good functionality of supporting multiple Linux boxes, multiple virtual Linux instances, we'll call them that. It does not today support Windows, which VMware will do. He said that by about the end of this year, they would have a release that would support Windows. And so, you know, that obviously makes it a more attractive opportunity for lots of companies. He put up some stats, they weren't official, that he indicated that he felt that Xen actually had better performance than VMware. So you get better performance out of the box. You know, obviously that's something that needs to be checked by real-world experience. But that's how I would compare it, how I would compare the two.
And in the case of other areas, you mentioned BI data warehousing. Now, I wasn't aware that MySQL had the capacity to manage a very large warehouse of the type that that Sabre is using it for. Are there other tools, other open source tools that Sabre has applied to that application?
That Sabre has applied, no.
Or they, that one might they, apply.
Well, you know, the clear data warehousing sort of breaks into three issues. One is the data storage, which is kind of, in this case, the MySQL stuff that we've discussed. The second is, you know, how do you look at the data? And that's typically a reporting issue. And there's a company out right now that kind of made a big splash, I'll tell you a bit about them, called Jasper Reports. And they're relatively recent. They were a company that was a commercial company. They had a commercial reporting tool. I think they found it a little difficult to get traction in that market up against Crystal and so forth. At the same time, there was a single guy located, somewhere in Eastern Europe, maybe Romania or Russia or something like that, that had come out with a product called Jasper, and it was an open source reporting tool. This company, the commercial company, actually hired that guy, brought him in, redirected their company, renamed themselves Jasper Reports, and they now have an open source reporting tool, which is very powerful. The third piece of data warehousing is getting the data into it. And that's always a challenge because you want to bring in data from disparate sources. It's the so-called extract, transform, and load, ETL. And the two of those companies it wasn't the two companies, it was Jasper Reports and Postgres and a company called Kettle, which is an open source product to do ETL stuff, have just announced a joint effort to deliver a kind of an integrated business intelligence stack. And those are all open source products available, no charge.
So you really can construct a very robust data warehouse, you're saying, based just on open source products. Now you mentioned companies selling these products. We see, of course, there's open source that's out in the public domain that you can download and use the applications. And then there are, in some cases, these applications are sold by a company. Yet the source, the license itself, is free. So what's the business model there? How do you make money with open source?
Well, Paul, you've just hit on the $64,000 question. That is an area that there are some established business models that I'll talk about, but what I'll say is that that's still evolving. And, you know, everyone's trying different models. And I'll talk about a couple of them. I mean, the first and foremost one is support and services. So, you know, in other words, you get MySQL, you download it, and you say, you know, this is a really important part of my infrastructure. I really want to get commercial support for it. So you can turn to MySQL, and they'll sell you support. So you can, you know, call them and say, I've got this problem, or there's a bug, or whatever. And so, for example, Sabre has a commercial relationship with MySQL AB, the company that distributes that. So that's one model. Another model is what I call the razor and razor blade model. So, you know, there's maybe a million copies of some product out there. A company will say, you know, we'll build some commercial software that integrates with or sits on top of that open source piece to make it more useful or more robust or perform better. And they'll sell that under a commercial license, and that's how they fund their activities. They will still participate or be the sole creators of the open source product, which they distribute as open source. And then they have another product that they basically sell under a traditional license, and that's how they fund themselves. A third model that's getting a lot of activity these days is appliances. Maybe I should say our appliances. Basically, people taking open source products and putting them into an easy-to-use form factor, so you don't have to do all the installation and configuration. You buy an appliance and come put it into your network, plug it in, and it's up and running. So, for example, most of the small, the Soho routers, small office, home office routers that you can buy for $39 down at your local electronic superstore are all based on Linux. So Linux is basically being delivered as an appliance form factor. Another example of that is a company that I wrote about in my last Golden's Rules column. It was a category winner at the Linux World last week. A company called Astero. They basically deliver a hardware appliance that has a complete range of security, edge security products, so VPN, firewall, antivirus, and so forth. And it's delivered in a small 1U platform. And it costs, I don't know, $800 or $1,000. And that's an appliance form factor. So that's another way that open companies make money out of open source.
Interesting.
So several business models, and they're still evolving.
And the users of the ubiquitous TiVo digital video recorder might be familiar also that is a Linux-based product as well.
And an awesome one. I just happened to be talking to somebody from my publisher at the show, and he said, oh, yeah, we've got a thing that TiVo supports that basically you can plug it into the Ethernet, download the files from the TiVo, and put those onto your computer and watch them. And he said, so I'm going to watch them on the plane going home. And I said, well, why don't you set the DVD? And he goes, well, as a file, you're not spinning that disk, and so your battery lasts a lot longer.
Of course. It's in memory or it's on your hard disk. Right.
It's
efficient power
management. So, you know, TiVo is in a way, creating that. One of the things you'll hear about open source a lot is this kind of concept of community and improvement. And TiVo's really participating in that and making ways for people to, you know, add value or extract additional value with their products. And so that was, I mean, I knew that TiVo was pretty supportive of that kind of thing, but I wasn't aware of that particular example. But I said, wow, that's great.
And obviously extensible by virtue of the fact that the source code can be modified. You have people out there who can modify the TiVo services and distribute those. Distributed add-on products. Let's talk about security a little bit, because that's an important area of IT operations where I know security, where open source has been making some inroads. Many people are familiar with the Snort intrusion detection tool and many others I know that are being developed. Is this a growth area for open source now?
Yeah, it's a growth area of open source usage. I mean, there's a lot of great security products that are open source based, available for use. Again, you know, kind of like business intelligence, security is one of those things that everybody goes, yeah, that would be good to do. But it kind of always comes after the key stuff of how do we run transactions, how do we keep the lights on, so to speak, with IT. So it's an area that, you know, sort of always comes up short of dollars. And that makes it a very attractive way to take advantage of open source. And there's a lot of great open source products that are oriented around security that are widely used, really widely used.
Let me ask you, one thing misperception or a perception that I often see is that, well, how can a security product, an open source security product, really be effective considering that the bad guys can get hold of the source code?
Yeah, I mean, that's a common question, not only around security products, but really about all of open source. The notion of, well, if people are seeing the source code, wouldn't they figure out good ways to attack it? Or couldn't they sneak in and put in some so-called Trojan horse code that, you know, basically lets some bad guy or bad person, you know, get into that thing and have it transfer $1 million out of my bank account, which actually would be pretty tough, but, you know, the concept. And that's a common question about open source. You know, is it more vulnerable rather than kind of the proprietary model that says, we've got complete control over the source code, it's these eight people in a room, and, you know, they control what goes in. So it's kind of, you know, that closed versus open model. I don't know that there's any definitive answer that, you know, anybody's done a, you know, an exhaustive study or something like that that said that. What I will say is that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that open source makes products, open source development models make products more vulnerable. And a lot of people assert that it's likely that they're more secure because a lot of people can look at the source code. Many eyes can examine it and catch anomalies, whereas in that closed model, you're really relying on those eight people. Well, what's to stop the bad guys from putting a bad person into that development group and putting those Trojan horses in there? So, you know, I've looked at both sides, and I have to say that I, you know, through both the kind of experience, in other words, looking at open source, and also through what I believe about the open source development model, I feel that open source is at least as secure, generally speaking, as commercial software or proprietary software.
Let's step back to a question we were talking about earlier with working with a company versus simply taking the software out of the public domain, or is not really public domain, but taking it out of a free area like a bulletin board versus working with a company, buying a support license. If you're an enterprise, what are the trade-offs? When do you think it's appropriate to engage a company like a MySQL that is in the open source business or Red Hat or Novell versus just doing it yourself, rolling it your own?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the absence of a commercial supplier, as a user, you rely on what's called the community. And it's kind of an ambiguous term, but it generally means all the people who develop and use that product. And there's a lot of information sharing and self-help, or mutual help, I should say, available through the community. For many enterprises, that's plenty good enough. And many enterprises actually say, you know, we've used the community, and we think it's better than what we get than in the commercial realm of software. You know, in other words, commercial support. Paul, I'm sure I'm telling you something you're already aware of and probably most of the listeners are aware of. Lots of people are really dissatisfied with commercial support operations because they feel like they don't do such a great job. And so the community is very adequate for most people. Some companies say, you know, however, this is really strategic to me. I want to have a relationship with the copyright holder if there's a commercial entity, because if I get in a fix, you know, some kind of a bind, I want to be able to call them up and say, get the best developer available right now to fix that problem. That's typical of a situation where an open source product has become a strategic product within your infrastructure. And for example, for Sabre, MySQL is a strategic part of their infrastructure. So Travelocity, whenever you do a query through Travelocity and get back a list of flight segments that you might be interested in, that all gets served up through MySQL. So for them, you know, that if MySQL is not up and running, they're out of business.
So they need for them. In IT parlance, they call it the one throat to choke, I believe.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the one throat to choke. So it really depends. And I, you know, there's a lot of value in looking at commercial companies. I will say that many organizations, and even very sophisticated, very large organizations, choose to rely on community support and feel like it does a great job for them. And the statistics are roughly about 1% or less, maybe 2% of you know, real world users of open source turn to commercial support options.
Talk about some other new areas where open source is making inroads. What are some other products you've seen recently, or some categories that particularly excited you?
Well, gosh, one of the things that is very intriguing is, you know, we're entering a world of dirt cheap hardware and the so-called service-oriented architecture. And service-oriented architecture is kind of a way of saying, we're going to, rather than having tightly bound APIs, we're going to deliver these, deliver functionality up through a mechanism that basically anybody can call into this service, and particularly call across a network from outside the firewall or something like that. And, you know, that creates a world of, I'm going to, you know, if you envision a world where there's lots of those kinds of things, and I want to construct an app on the fly from drawing together a number of different services, so-called composite applications. You know, so how do you build those? You know, I mean, one way is to build, you know, is to do it an old-fashioned way, you know, sort of hand-coding stuff. But to build a composite application for the future, you're going to want a very rapid kind of platform. There's a company that's just come out with a product called ActiveGrid. And ActiveGrid is a product designed to be able to look out to SOA-oriented architectures and rapidly develop applications. And rather than a sort of a kind of a application server model, so-called J2EE, where you have this kind of very complex, heavyweight thing that you've got to really tune and tweak and got to learn everything to do, ActiveGrid says, you know, in a world of really cheap hardware, why optimize for software performance? We'll make it easy to build these things and rely on a gridded network of inexpensive Linux boxes, hardware, to draw those apps together and get the performance we need. Really interesting. And I think, you know, that's a huge trend. Everyone wants to look at this kind of easy-to-build, service-oriented architecture because that seems like an easier way to get apps up and running and draw together disparate kinds of resources. So that's a very promising area. They've just launched at Linux World. They actually made their stuff available, and I think that's a product that's going to get a lot of attention and a lot of use. And certainly, my company, I can envision lots of uses, you know, with the companies we work with to build this kind of system. So that's very, I think that's got a lot of opportunity as well.
Any other areas? One area I've been hearing more about is content management. Is anything exciting going on there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, content management is, within open source, there's a surfeit of riches. And content management is a pretty important functionality within companies, because as you start to envision more of this kind of service-oriented world, a web-oriented world, you've got lots of different things that you want to make available through a website. The old model was you had a webmaster, or you had a little group of webmasters that would run these things. And that's a problem because it's a bottleneck. And also, they're not the experts in all the different areas of a company. And so content management is a way of basically enabling lots of different people to contribute content into a website that can be made available. So you have a control mechanism through a webmaster or a web group, but you free people up to deliver content. And the way that's typically done is through what's called a content management system. So it's a way of version control of content so that somebody can say, okay, we're ready to, you know, we're going to go from 1.5 to 1.8 of this document. It's also a way of enabling different people to contribute content to different parts of a system and control that so that, you know, I get to contribute in the area that has to do with the area I'm interested in. Paul, you get to contribute content in the area that you're in, but not vice versa. I don't get to put it into your stuff because I don't have that right. So it's control as well, authorization and authentication. And this is a way of really enabling lots and lots of information to get delivered up. There are probably 15 or 20 very capable open source content management systems. One that's very well known is Zope. And Zope is kind of an object-oriented content management system built on top of Python, which is a scripting language. And interestingly enough, there is a portal product built on top of Zope called Plone. And Plone basically is a kind of a pre-configured with a set of components that enable you to build a portal very easily and do content management through a portal. Another product that's quite well known is Mambo. And Mambo is very widely used, very popular, very capable. It was the February Linux World's product of the show. And at the one that just happened last week, it won in its category. Very capable product. And really very much a community product. And there's many others. Drupal is another one. I mean, there's a ton of them. They're all available to use and offer really great functionality.
In trying to make a choice, I mean, you have cases where you have so many options available in the open source world. Are there rating boards of some kind? Is there somewhere I could go to find out the relative features and quality of these different options?
Yeah, there's. I mean, that's a classic question. You know, sort of how do I figure out what the right candidate pool is? And then beyond that is, well, given my requirements, how do the products that are in that candidate pool really stack up? You know, the one method, of course, is just kind of the Bush telegraph, you know, kind of asking around. But when you really get to a place of saying, okay, I really want to see if this is going to match, you know, my requirements, and does it really fit, you know, the way I work, and does this product offer the kinds of things I need in terms of, is there good training available or documentation? We've developed a methodology called the Open Source Maturity Model. And basically, that's a model that enables you to take any given open source product, kind of help develop your set of requirements. What is it my company needs for this app? And then map that across a number of product elements like software, support, training, documentation, integration, and professional services, and figure out how well does it map up to what I need to do for the use that I'm going to make of it. Am I going to use it in just a little departmental system, or is this really a production system? You know, depending on that, you're going to need a more, what we call a mature product, one that's fuller featured, that has more capabilities in it, in all those product elements. And that's what we use. And basically, it's a system you use, you run a product through it, it comes out with a score on a scale of 1 to 100. There's recommended minimums depending on that kind of use you're going to use. And it gives you a way of really kind of assessing, is this really going to fit into my infrastructure? Going forward, I think it's going to be a lot more important because what's happening is more mainstream organizations are starting to use open source. And they're less early adopters, they're less technically sophisticated, they're less willing to roll up their sleeves. They want products that they can kind of bring in and have them work. So the open source maturity model is something that we use, and it's available at the Navica site, just navica.com/OSMM. It is open source, so you can take it and do whatever you will with it, and that's a good way to go about that.
Another issue that would seem to be on my mind if I was an IT manager bringing open source into my organization is that I am going to have people who are skilled at working with the source code. I'm going to need to be able to modify that code. Is there a problem finding and hiring those people these days? Are they in short supply?
Well, what I would say is, first off, most organizations do not modify the source code of a product. Using open source does not impose a requirement or capability of, you know, doing source code modifications. The right is there if you choose to, under the licensing terms, and many organizations do, but the vast majority of organizations don't. They use open source software as it is. And what they focus on is configuring it and integrating it with their systems. So in that sense, they treat it very much like commercial products as they would get. In terms of the skill sets around open source in general, there's a lot of discussion about this, a lot of controversy. Particularly around Linux and Windows, many people assert, well, you know, one of the reasons it's, you know, that Windows is a lot better and has a better TCO is that Linux people are really, really hard to find. I'm not so convinced of that. And, you know, I think that I had a piece of email from somebody recently kind of complaining, saying, you know, it's you can't just go to monster.com and post a thing for a Linux person and get a flood of resumes the way you can with for a Windows person. And I wrote back and said, well, you're going to have to be a little more creative, I guess, but, you know, it's not like they don't exist. Go to a Linux users group meeting, you know, go to a Linux bulletin board and post an interest. To me, this is a very common problem with any kind of new technology. There was a time when Windows NT was a new product, and it was really hard to find those people. You know, and the world adjusted. People change their skill sets. They get trained. They learn new things. So I think it's a transitional problem. I don't think it's going to be a long-term problem. And certainly, I don't think that I don't believe that companies should back off from exploring or implementing open source because, you know, open source people are like Yeti. You know, nobody's ever seen them. I don't think that really is the case at all.
That's a unique analogy, Bernard. I like that. In the last of just a few minutes we have here, let's talk about the future and how open source is going to impact commercial software as well. First of all, we've seen this tremendous growth in open source applications in the last year or two. Where is that going to go? You said open source is moving up the stack. Are there some new areas that we're going to see open source alternatives where we don't have them right now?
You know, what I would say is in terms of the areas that open source will play in, it's hard for me to think of any areas that won't be subject to having open source entrants. Really, the only thing that gates open source products from entering any particular segment is an interest level in developers. One area that open source really hasn't made much of a presence in yet, and it's unclear how much it will be, is the verticals. And if you think about that, as I said, you know, many of the people who get involved with this are scratching an itch, or you know, they have a passion for doing it, or you know, they're intellectually curious. It just seems like you can find people who like to do software programming with that kind of temperament. You just don't find that many people who say, you know, I'm an oil and gas expert, and when I go home at night, I want to do some more oil and gas. I don't know. So that's a place that hasn't been. What I would say that we're likely to see, though, is an enormous explosion of use of open source, both in terms of what we can traditionally think of as big IT shops and so forth, subject to those things that we've talked about, cost pressures, you know, being tired of kind of the old commercial models. But one of the things that's really going to burgeon over the next 5 years is, because open source is a much lower price point, a much lower cost, organizations and even whole sectors of the globe that have traditionally been locked out of using software because it was so expensive and they couldn't afford it are all going to have access to using software. And that's going to be very interesting and very exciting, because all of a sudden, you know, organizations, you know, in Tierra del Fuego or, you know, Vietnam will be applying the same kind of IT stuff that we've done and gaining the same kinds of insights and transactional capabilities and efficiencies through it. And that's going to be a really interesting development over the next few years. So that's a place that we'll see open source go. So, you know, I think it's going to be a very exciting time. The commercial software sector, I think, is also going to be very interesting, because there's going to be margin pressure. And so they're going to have to restructure the way they do business. And that's also going to be interesting as well. So what's that Chinese proverb? May you live in interesting times, and that means, you know, it could be really great and it could be really kind of dangerous. That's going to be the software sector for the next 5 years.
Is there a role, or what do you think the role of commercial providers will be in the future, considering that there will be more and more robust alternatives in the open source world? Does the role of the commercial software provider change to be, as you mentioned, more niche-oriented or more support-oriented? What happens to these companies in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, what I expect to see is that in the past, software has been sold at a very high price point with a lot of bundled stuff. You know, the company is really taken care of, you know, figuring out does it integrate with all this stuff, and asserting that, oh yeah, it works with this product. They've done huge amounts of marketing and doing a lot of marketing education. You know, they've been in a situation where, you know, if you were a big company, you said, well, we're not really sure how this will work with our infrastructure. They'll trot in three or four people to do an architectural assessment. You know, all those kinds of things have been bundled within that license price. As the margins come down, what we'll see is those services getting split out and being something that they charge for. And from the point of view of a provider, you're going to have to be on top of your game. You know, you're going to have to prove your value. You won't be able to just say, well, here's the license fee, and by the way, we throw all this stuff in, and maybe it's good and maybe it isn't. Because you'll be up against, you know, somebody providing that same kind of service for an open source product who they say, that's what I do. That's my specialty. You know, I'm going to be excellent at it. So it's going to be competitive, which for a user is always better. For a customer, competition is always better. So that's what's, you know, that's, I think that's going to be the role. They're going to have to start splitting out their services. They're going to have to start focusing on them and really making sure they deliver, you know, best-in-class services. And, you know, delivering a kind of a menu of services, which you'll have to pick and choose from.
And the big winners in all this, I take it, are the customers of those services.
Yeah, it's not a pure win because, you know, I don't want to just bash the old model. A lot of people in the open source world go, oh, yeah, those guys, the commercial guys, they're awful. One of the things that has been, you know, a very valuable service is they kind of delivered this product bundle. They took care of saying, okay, here's the software. You know, here is a support mechanism. We'll write the documentation or make sure the documentation gets done. We'll develop a training program and spread it out through a bunch of training partners. And we'll have a services model, and we'll certify those services providers and those training providers. And, you know, we'll take care of making sure that the integrations get done. Well, in a world where they don't have as much revenue, all of a sudden, you know, there's going to be less of that. And if you want that, it's going to be kind of, I need to pay for it. Or, I need to locate those resources. To go back to the open source maturity model, that's a big part of it. Where do I find those resources, and how do I assess them? Because in the absence of, you know, a certified training program, how do I find out who the best trainers are for if I'm interested in Apache Axis? So you got to, you know, so there's more control from the point of view of users, but there'll also be more responsibility for that. So overall, though, you know, it's a big win. It is a huge win because the locus of control, the locus of power in information technology is shifting from vendors to users.
And that's always a good thing. And on that note, we will close. My thanks to our guest, Bernard Golden, CEO of Navica. Very interesting perspective on the open source world, and we'd like to have you back again soon and talk about some other new developments. Would you join us again?
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me, Paul. I'd be glad to do another with you anytime.
Fascinating changes going on in the software industry, and certainly very exciting changes if you're a software user. So that's it for this Search Enterprise Linux podcast. We'll be back again soon. Thanks for joining us today.